So today we're going to talk about protein's three-dimensional structure and its implications. So here's our balled up protein that we denatured last time, folded up nicely like this, and here it is in our jacuzzi. So you see it kind of stays together, and yet it's not like a rock here. It has some instability, and if we increase the temperature too much, it would start to unravel. What's holding it together? What does it look like? And in general, why? Right. So let's start with, they're going to have four levels of protein structure. The first is primary. And the primary structure is just the sequence itself. And just the sequence itself, no matter what the side groups are, already has some implications in terms of the some constraint on what three-dimensional shape that wiggly rope can take up. So if we consider, for example, just these backbone molecules, backbone atoms, and forget any influence of the R's temporarily, we can see here we're focusing, and we have a handout, 3-3 for this. Handouts are generally one behind, and I don't get as far as I hope each time. So we have the C double bond O left over from this left-hand residue here, and then the right-hand residue starting here with the N. Now, because the electronegativities are different, as we learned very early, there's going to be these little delta negatives on the oxygen, more electronegative oxygen and nitrogen, and delta positives on the hydrogen and carbon. So the result is now we have two atoms bonded to each other through this covalent bond, and in addition now, they have a delta plus on the carbon and a delta minus on the nitrogen. So that's effectively making another bond here, right? Another electrical bond, weaker than a covalent bond, not the true sharing of electrons, but a bond nevertheless. And there's enough reality to that bond so that we can draw it this way, that we have a partial double-bonded character now between the C and the N. And that is enough of a double bond so that you no longer have free rotation about this C-N pair. Just like in that double bond in the fatty acids that were unsaturated. So there's no rotation here. And although we've talked about the tetra, and I showed you the tetrahedral nature of carbon when it's bonded to four things, carbon when it's bonded to just three things, like it is here, O-C-N, is actually planar. Similarly, nitrogen bonded to its usual three things, right, is planar. So because there's no rotation and because of this planar character, all of these four red atoms are going to be in one plane. Now, in addition, because there's planarity around this nitrogen with its three atoms bound to it, all of these blue atoms are also going to be in one plane. And you'll notice that the C double bond N is a member of both of these planes. So as a result, all six of these atoms, the blue and the red, are in this one purple plane. All these six are forced to stay in one plane. Now, this is going to continue for the next, as we go along the polypeptide chain, so that these purple atoms are all in one chain on the left, in graphic 5, and on the right, these six atoms are also in one plane, but there's a pivot point between these two. There's nothing that says that this right-hand plane has to be coplanar with the left-hand plane. So otherwise, we just have this stiff rod. So there's still a lot of flexibility. So this is illustrated here in graphic 7. The two planes just sort of pivoting on this central carbon as it's drawn. And I tried to show you then by italicizing this, and that you can have free rotation then between the two planes. And that's shown from a picture in the book with balls and sticks the same way. And you see these plates. So the rope was not an accurate depiction. Because it was too flexible. It's really more like a chain. I like this, that left over from the late 60s from my wife.
It's getting kind of, 2010 is getting, I guess you still know about the 60s. So there's some constraint, more like a chain than like a belt and like a rope. And indeed, you can describe the position. Once the protein is folded up, these planes are all fixed by all the weak bonds holding the protein together. And you can describe each bond by the angle between the planes. That's part of the characterization of a folded structure. Okay, let's go to the next level of protein structure. And this is called secondary structure. Secondary structure involves interactions between backbone atoms. Again, we're still ignoring, for the moment, the R groups, the side chains. Again, if we look at the backbone atoms, we see that there's a C double bond O that's going to be able to form, that's got a delta negative down here, which is going to be able to form a hydrogen bond if it could find a hydrogen donor. And there are hydrogen donors here. Here's an NH. There's all these NHs, which are going to have a delta positive because electronegativity of the nitrogen is greater. So you have all these delta positive H's sticking out, and you have all these C double bond O minus, partial minus sticking out. So can they find each other? Well, I told you when we talked about the structure of water that hydrogen bond loses its force a lot as soon as you start to bend it significantly away from a straight line between the minus, plus, minus, the plus being the hydrogen in the middle. It's a hydrogen bond. So clearly, number one is not going to be able to line up with number two, say this oxygen with this hydrogen, graphic 9. But as we go down the line, number three also can't bend enough, but number four can't bend enough. But when we get to number five, it fits actually quite perfectly that even with this chain-like stiffness, but when you get down to number five, you have a very nice, and I've sort of drawn this backwards to indicate we're looping around, we have a very nice hydrogen bond, NHO, right? And of course, they're closer than this. They're sort of equidistant between the N and the H and the O and the H, almost. Well, so we could get one of these bonds, right? But if we had started here with number two, we would have found the same situation. We'd just have to go to number six and number three with number seven. And so this whole polypeptide chain has the possibility of just, and the probability of just looping around, much like that starch helix, into a helical structure. And this is various depictions of that helical structure. Here's maybe the simplest up here in the upper left, graphic 10, where the hydrogen bonds are indicated by these vertical lines and the backbone by this helical linear drawing, right? And if we consider where the R groups are, the R groups in this structure will be all sticking out because, in fact, the width of this helix is so tight that, in fact, it's just filled with electrons. We'll see in a second. In fact, we can see it right now. Here's a space-filling bottle of the, and this is called the alpha helix. I'm not sure where the alpha came from. Maybe it was the first secondary structure to be, yes, I think the first secondary structure to be proposed and verified. So if you look at this alpha helix end on, you see that it's just all filled in the middle, much like as our glucose ring was filled. So the R groups perforce are sticking out. Right? Here's another way of depicting it is just this so-called ribbon model, which we'll get to more a little later, where the ribbon itself, although it's flat and seems like it has some width, is just a depiction of the single polypeptide chain that's twisting around. Now, if we take a look at this from a ball and stick model, and just from the end, we can see that we know now the center is filled with electrons, but the outside green blobs here are the R groups sticking out. So it's a very nice looking structure. If this were this in fact is polyalanine because these gray groups on the outside are CH3, and so it doesn't look very ornate. But in fact, because these R groups could be anything in any particular protein, it's actually quite fuzzy and variegated as you go along the outside of this alpha helix. Hydrogens are not shown in this picture, in case you're confused looking at it later in more detail. So, here's actually the guy who figured this out, 63, not that long ago, Linus Pauling, a very famous structural chemist. And you see, it doesn't look that different from my wife's belt, these plates. This is not the only secondary structure that can form. There's a second. And in fact, there's only really two. There's variations on the theme a little bit, but there's basically two kinds of secondary structure, and that this satisfaction of hydrogen bonding between the backbone atoms has another solution. And this other solution is called the beta sheet or the beta pleated sheet. And this is harder for me to depict. This is a good time to consult the diagrams in your book, which are better and which are actually on your handout. Right? Still, to try and make it simpler, we can go along, let's say this is a window into a folded protein on the left here, graphic 12. And we're going along and we see the residues of the amino acids. The R groups have been ignored. And here's a C double bond O looking for an NH, and it can find an NH, not by looking further down on its own local region here, but some other region. And this is all a window, and all of these strands are connected in one polypeptide chain. So here's another region of the polypeptide that swings around and lines up with its NH forming a hydrogen bond to this CO. And then it starts zipping up. Its CO, which comes next, can hydrogen bond to the first guy's NH, etc., etc. Meanwhile, because the carbons are tetrahedral and sticking out, or even planar, sticking out in different directions, once it forms strand number 2 is forming a hydrogen bond to strand number 1, it also has a C double bond O, and it's not in a position to also form a double bond, a hydrogen bond with strand 1, but rather sticking out on the other side. Right? So, but it is free then to mate with another region that's coming along from somewhere in the protein. Because these straight lines are really crooked, if we looked at them end on, which I have right here, you see the resulting structure then is a sheet. And the sheet could be as little as just two strands, right? That's already a sheet. One is not a sheet. One is just a piece of the polypeptide. But as soon as you have this connection between two strands, it's a beta sheet. And the beta sheet can have 3, 4, 5, 6 or more, but not 100. So a low number, but okay. So what's the result for protein structure? Said all this. So here's another way of looking at it, sort of from the top, and I use it to illustrate a little bit more flexibility in how this beta sheet is formed. It's called pleated because of this crooked nature of the bonds. But beta sheet is synonymous to beta pleated sheet. So here's a region at the top coming along. And now, you can, because the polypeptide bond is oriented, we have the amino on the left, we can look at any particular amino acid and say, like this one here, here's a nitrogen. Here's this, as we go to the right of that, a central carbon. I know it is. It's got the R group and an H. And then the CO, what's left of the carboxyl. So this one is going left to right, just as we have by convention. But what about this guy? This guy, the second one down from the top, is the opposite of that. It's going from right to left, N, central carbon, CO. And you can't read it any other way. You can try. But the top one's going left to right, which is our convention, and the bottom was going anti-convention, right to left. And so these two strands are anti-parallel. And that's how most of the beta sheets are, because you think if you come out here, and then what's this end? You're going to come around somewhere else. This could be a very short loop and come right back. Or it could go out and explore other parts of be involved in the structure of other parts of the protein, and then only later, as further, come back, and you have this anti-parallel. Then this is coming around, and once again, we have let's see, at, right to left, NCO on strand 2. And on strand 3, we have, where's the central carbon? There it is, NC, C double bond O. So this one's back to the left to right. So these three are an anti-parallel sheet. But it's not the only way this could happen. Here's two strands lined up, the third line and the fourth line. NCO, left to right, and the bottom one, why, it's NC, C double bond O again. So these are actually parallel. So how could that happen if this is looping around? Well, the loop's got to be a little longer. You can just come along here on the third line, come out and around, and then come back. So, and that forms perfectly good hydrogen bonds, even though they don't look so straight here. They're perfectly good hydrogen bonds, so you can have either parallel or anti-parallel. this is shown here in graphic 14. Anti-parallel, easy to draw. Parallel, not so easy to draw, and not so easy to form, but they're formed. So you have two forms of this beta sheet. So, and that's all we have to know about secondary structure. They form these two kinds. Why is one kind formed and the other as opposed to the other? Or can we assume then that all proteins are all bound up in these secondary structures, because it doesn't matter what the side groups are? These are formed between backbone atoms. Secondary structure defined by regular repeated interactions between the atoms of the backbone. So both of these structures I've shown you are characterized by that definition. Well, you don't have that because we've ignored the side groups all this time. So you can imagine, for instance, in an alpha helix, suppose all the R groups were aspartates and glutamates. These are negatively charged side groups. They don't like to be right above one another in this helix, because you have electrical repulsion. Or suppose they're hydrophobic, and they're sort of pulling themselves together with such hydrophobic force that it distorts the helix and even unwinds it. So the R groups will influence whether you can have a secondary structure or not. The secondary structure you might think of as always trying to form, but the R groups are preventing, say, the polypeptide just to go to a helix from N-terminal to C-terminal in just one long helix. You almost never find that. Rather, you find bends, and you see that ball here. We'll have sections that are in alpha helix. Here's an orange one, a short one. They can be short, right, or long. Here's a pink one, right? And there's this green beta sheet. So this is typical. You have a lot of the residues of a folded protein, a large percentage are in secondary structure, but it's more like, I don't know, 60-70%. And the other 30% are in loops that connect everything together, like this purple business here, right? And they are not in secondary structure. So now we move to tertiary structure, which is simply the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide chain. And we have a depiction here of such a protein in what's called the ribbon model. And this is the most common way of talking about proteins so we can communicate about protein structure to each other. Right. So what the drawer of this picture, which is reflecting the results of X-ray diffraction and determination of all those atoms, so they know this is a structure. Right. And they are conveying to us, there's this big beta sheet in purple. There are one, two, maybe three, four distinguishable alpha helices, right? And you can see there's this alpha helix at the top is just opposed to this blue beta sheet. It's being held together how? By now the R groups. So in the tertiary structure, we finally consider the R groups, which are unique for each protein by definition, and which give each protein a unique or usually unique tertiary structure. So you notice a third part of this diagram are these thin lines, which are not in ribbons, but is just the backbone of loops, which are not in secondary structure and which serve not only just to connect secondary structures, but they have a life of their own. This loop over here is doing something, and this loop is interacting with this loop, and that's why the protein is folded, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail in a minute. Now, often, I called that 3 alpha helices last year. It looks like 4 to me as I look at it today. Now, it always breaks my heart after the first exam when I give a picture like this and ask something about it, and 12% of you will say, this ribbon here, this is a beta sheet, or this one over here, this blue line is a beta sheet, right? Because, you know, it's wide, it's a ribbon. And inside that ribbon, there's a bunch of polypeptides interacting to give that flatness. This is not right. These ribbons are single polypeptide chains. This ribbon that's wound around, you don't get that mistake. Only for the beta sheets I get that mistake. Right? So this is a picture without any backbone showing, just a backbone, without any side chain showing, and so that we can see the structure of the folded protein. And each one of these flat ribbons is just a single CCN, CCN polypeptide chain. What's holding the loops together and what's holding everything together? Well, it's just all four of those weak bonds that we introduced after we introduced the hydrogen bond talking about water, right? So we have, for instance, an ionic bond. Why not? We have a lysine that's positively charged here. And you've got the structures up here, so you don't have to look at your sheet. Here's the side chain of lysine with its NH3 plus at pH 7. Here's the aspartate with its COO minus. And if they're both coming out of this one's coming out of an alpha helix. This one's coming out of a beta sheet. And I know I've just made this up, but and so we could have an ionic bond. Similarly, if we have a valine here, and there happens to be a phenylalanine here, and that happening is after a billion years of evolution, we have two hydrophobic groups being pushed together now by the aqueous environment. You have a hydrophobic interaction. And the good old hydrogen bond again. Why not? Here's a couple of serines with OHs, polar molecules, not charged. They can form a hydrogen bond. Or that ion-dipole interaction, which is an ion, say, from the COO minus of this aspartate, or could be a glutamate, and asparagine, which is this amide group, which is highly polar but not charged, as you now know from memorizing your functional groups and their behavior. So you have an ion-dipole interaction. And finally, you could have just, to make this turn, this alanine, this serine, have no particular attraction by any of these bonds, but they're pushed close enough together so that van der Waals forces come into play and help stabilize this this fantasy loop. So it's pretty straightforward, although this is the part that we really have trouble predicting. You know, we can understand it. Once we see the structure, yes, it makes sense. Now, there is one, besides these four types of weak bonds, and these four types of weak bonds are sufficient to explain almost all tertiary structures. But we have to talk about one exceptional bond, which is not weak at all. It's strong. It's a regular covalent bond. And that's if we have two cysteine side groups that are close enough to interact, maybe close enough because of all these weak bonds have brought them there, because they have they have some intrinsic attraction to each other, because cysteine is kind of hydrophobic. How does that happen? They're connected to each other by something called a disulfide bond, and so there's some more nomenclature for you. Here's the side group of cysteine. There's, in this case, R is just the rest of the molecule, which here is the common NCC amino acid backbone part. Right? So you don't get confused. This is now we're showing the side chain, and consider the rest of the molecule to be R in this case. So here's the side chain, CH2SH. And here's another cysteine drawn backwards, SH, CH2, and R. The SH is called a sulfhydryl group. And so cysteine can exist in this free sulfhydryl group form, or, and although you might want to call this cysteine, we have called it cysteine, which is a little funny, you know, cysteine. And we pronounce that E, because unfortunately, once they get connected, they're called something else, which is cysteine, which is the same word except without the E. Right? So two cysteines can get together in the presence of oxygen. A chemical reaction can take place, an actual new formation of new bonds. Just as in the closure of the glucose ring, we had actual chemical reaction and formation of new bonds to form that ring. And we didn't require a catalyst in that case. I said exceptionally, because the two groups were already on one molecule and didn't need something to bring them together, say. Right. Same is true here. They're already, these two cysteines are already brought together by all those weak bonds in that loop that I just showed. So they're right there in the presence of oxygen. And so this favorable reaction will go forward. If you have a lot of oxygen, it will drive it. And you will the oxygen atom will accept these two hydrogens from the two cysteines, become water, H2O. And the two cysteines will now bond to each other. And so this bond is called a disulfide bond. It's strong and covalent. And will sort of lock in this tertiary structure. You don't always find these in proteins, but they're common enough. But you should think of it more as a locking in. We should be sure to distinguish that these SH groups are more like OH groups. They are not acids. What's coming off here is not a proton. What's coming off is a hydrogen nucleus proton with its electron. That's a completely different kettle of fish than the loss of a proton, which is just an acid. Right? So the whole electron is moving, and it's the electrons that are making these bonds. And so these electrons are now on this hydrogen are ending up attached to oxygen to make water. And the electrons on these sulfurs, formerly attached to this hydrogen, are now being used to share between these two sulfurs to form the disulfide bond. So this is called a reduction reaction, rather an oxidation reaction. So the removal of hydrogens is, and we'll talk more about oxidation in a general form, in more general forms when we talk about energy metabolism. So these two sulfhydryls have been oxidized. They've lost hydrogens, which at present we can use as our temporary definition of oxidation. And oxygen, on the other hand, has accepted these. That whenever you have an oxidation, you have to have the opposite. Somebody that one guy is losing hydrogen atoms, then somebody else has to be receiving them. These are said to be reduced. They've got them, added to them, and yet they're called reduced. So it's like pH and unsaturated fatty acids. You have to just accept this is a. This is there is some rationale to this because actually we're talking about the electrons being lost or accepted, and when and so this word comes from the valency of metals that is changed when you gain or lose electrons. So oxygen has been reduced. When you have an oxidation, you always have a reduction. If you have a reduction, there must be something being oxidized. Here, the oxidizing agent, the acceptor of the hydrogens, was oxygen. And oxygen generally around, although not always. And there's the water that's formed. And so this was named separately because in the old days when they started hydrolyzing proteins down to their and breaking these peptide bonds with acid at a high temperature, they would get all these amino acids, and they got 21 amino acids. So they got this guy, which was cysteine, and the sulfur-sulfur bond was not broken by this acid treatment. And then when they analyzed it, they saw it was like this double amino acid. And and so they gave it this separate name. But it's not something that's... when you consider the 20 amino acids, it's something that's formed later after the polypeptide chain is made. It's not considered a separate amino acid from cysteine. Just a special case. So in this case, Sometimes there are actually some catalysts that would help this, but usually it's not necessary. So, we have our tertiary structure then of our protein. This is kind of this ribbon model. If we would selectively destroy these disulfide bonds, most cases I know of where this has been done, and you can do this in a mild way, you can reduce them instead of to reverse the process, add hydrogen across them. Generally, it doesn't disrupt the tertiary structure. So the cysteines are really can be considered as locking things in. So maybe if you went to raise the temperature of this guy until it starts to fall apart at 40 or 50 or 60 degrees centigrade, 60 is already water you can't stick your finger in, just a little too hot, with these disulfides, maybe these wires, it holds together, but if I didn't have them here, it would come apart. So here's some different depictions of proteins. You could have just a simple trace of a line. And you might want to draw attention to one part of it. This is the overall tertiary structure, and here's a small molecule that's bound in a pocket of this protein. Here's a few side groups you might want to draw attention to. So that's kind of useful for doing that. This one we already talked about. Here's a space-filling model, which are always harder to interpret, but give you a much more realistic view of what the protein looks like. It's really this ball that's filled with electrons. There's no spaces left in here, generally, or maybe a few crevices. Right? Here's a disulfide bond, two sulfurs bound to each other in this gold part on graphic 20. That's insulin, which is a small protein. And here's a funny-looking one in which the charge on the surface of this space-filling model has been depicted. I think it was Barry Honig up at the medical school that first did this. And now you could color in red or blue depending on whether the overall regions here are negatively charged or positively charged. In general, as we said in the beginning, the outside of the protein is hydrophilic and most of the charge groups would be outside. But there could be some inside if they're sort of bonded to each other, a glutamate and a lysine stuck inside. In fact, the ionic bond's even stronger when it's in such a hydrophobic neighborhood in the middle of a protein. Although we've been depicting this simple picture of tertiary structure as just this one continuous ball, in reality, when you look at many proteins, most of them have regions, and first of all, they're more complicated than this. This is short. They have regions that are folded up locally, and these are called domains, and can be sort of recognized. So over here in this ribbon model, you can recognize that this, most obvious is down here, this alpha-3 region is just folded up on itself in a local region of the protein. And then there's a little linking part here, and then there's another region that's just folded up into itself and doesn't have a lot of contact with this blue region, this purple region. There is some contact at the interface between these two, but you can see that most of the interactions in this purple region are purple-purple interactions, and then green-green, and red-red, and yellow-yellow. So this has five domains. These are called protein domains, and you can see them in a space-filling model more dramatically this way, where the red one now is behind the yellow and green one up here. So proteins often fold, and this could be probably a result of evolution and the way these proteins evolved to do their jobs. They became kind of modular, each domain contributing a certain aspect of the job. That's what it's thought to be. Sometimes, so this is, you can't see this so well on the board, I think, but you have this on your handout, 4.2. And some of them become very fanciful structures. Looking at one end, you see it's all beta sheets, like a big plate. Or over here, these beta sheets turning around to make kind of a cylinder, right? And you can also get cylinders made from a bunch of alpha helices that are just joined side to side to each other and curve around.
At the top, we have a difference between the space-filling model and the ribbon depiction. And this is quite interesting. On the upper right, which I think I have amplified here. Yeah. On the upper right, you have these two different proteins. When I say different proteins, they must, by definition, have different primary sequences. Now, maybe they're pretty closely related, similar, but maybe not that similar. We find cases where two single polypeptide proteins have some similarity, but most of the amino acid sequence is actually different. And yet, when you do the X-ray crystallography and look at the structure, look how similar these two are. If you look carefully, you see they're not identical. This one's got this loop on the left, the left one, and this one's a little straighter over there. And so the loop parts, even though the loop parts are occurring in the same places, they have a slightly different structure. But the secondary structures and the relation of the secondary structures to each other are almost identical. And yet these are two independent proteins with largely different amino acid sequences. So what has happened is that this particular structure was found to be useful for the function of this protein. And it was gotten into this shape with two different solutions. Remember that all possible conformations. So here's the protein could take. So here's two different solutions that ended up with the same three-dimensional structure, which was suited to a particular task for that protein. I always thought that was quite interesting. Let's go to the last level, quaternary structure. So we have the three-dimensional structure of a single polypeptide, but most proteins, are associated with more than one chain. So a protein that has no quaternary structure, and there are many, is called a monomeric protein. If it has two chains associated with each other, it's called a dimeric protein, or a homodimer in this case, because the two chains are identical. The two polypeptide chains are identical. And how are these held together? The same story as that loop, the four weak bonds, and even the strong disulfide bond. The two polypeptides don't have to be the same. Here's a dimeric protein which has two different polypeptide chains connected to each other. So that's a heterodimer. And there's a heterotetramer, which could have four different ones. In this case, it's two different ones, which is enough, two pairs, which is enough to give it the hetero prefix. And they can get quite large. And in fact, there's no particular endpoint here. You can get structures which are no longer called just proteins, but rather assembly of proteins, but they look not so different from this. Lots of polypeptide chains held together. There could be 100 proteins, and some of the huge, actually, organelles which are in the cell are just these huge associations of proteins. Most proteins are not in such big structures. Most of them look like this, tetramers, could be trimer, which are more unusual, dimers. That's the more common case. So the association of more than one polypeptide in a protein is called quaternary structure, and that's our final level that we'll talk about. They're also called multimeric proteins. Let's take an example. The hemoglobin we talked about earlier actually is a heterotetramer of two alpha chains and two different, although similar, beta chains. Right? They're kind of small. So you have this heterotetramer, that is hemoglobin, that's what's binding the oxygen in your blood. The whole four chains together is called a protein, which has the name hemoglobin. So actually what I was talking about earlier when we got that Ingram's experiment, fingerprinting experiment, he was looking at the beta chain of hemoglobin. So you have to get careful then about how you talk about it. So are you talking about what is the beta chain? Is that the protein or is it always the whole thing? The whole thing is the protein. If you're going to talk about beta, you have to say, well, it's a subunit of hemoglobin. It's the beta subunit of hemoglobin or the alpha. Right? Hemoglobin has four subunits. You talk like that. So the individual polypeptide chains in the quaternary structure are called subunits. What is the molecular weight then becomes kind of a iffy question. Usually molecular weight refers to all the weights of the atoms that are held together in a covalent structure, which is the molecule, like glucose, 180 molecular weight. There's no doubt about it. Right? And if you had 100 glucoses in cellulose, it would be 18,000. Here, the molecular weight of this single polypeptide chain constituting the alpha subunit
is 16,000. Okay, so is that? But that's not hemoglobin. That's just the subunit molecular weight of hemoglobin. And it by because I said they were similar, it turns out in this case that the beta subunit also about 16,000. So the four together, if you weighed them, they would be 64,000. But now, so if I ask you then, the molecular weight of hemoglobin is 16 times 4, but I just say it's 64,000, even though it kind of breaks the rule of the way we think about molecular weight of all the atoms held together by covalent bonds, because these bonds between the any two subunits are not covalent bonds. There's no disulfides. They're just held together by the weak bonds. Still, we talk about a protein molecular weight, and we usually just drop the protein. Molecular weight of hemoglobin is 64,000. Molecular weight of albumin is 60,000, but it's only one polypeptide chain. So we make no distinction. If we would isolate hemoglobin in a test tube out of a red blood cell, it would look like this. These are strong enough so that the subunits associate with each other under native conditions. Surely, if we denatured it, the four chains would fly apart. Here's another example of a heterotetrameric protein, immunoglobulin, which is an antibody. Here the depiction's a little different. Now we have, since they're vertical, we don't know which is the amino end and which is the carboxyl end. It's not important for this discussion. If we were on its side, maybe I should have drawn it on its side, and then we would know just from this straight line that's a polypeptide chain. It doesn't look like this. We know it's all folded up. This is just a depiction so we can talk about it. And these little lines that are connecting them are indicating the weak bonds. So we have two L chains for light because they're smaller molecular weight and two heavy chains because they're longer. So all immunoglobulins, or many immunoglobulins, have this kind of structure, too heavy and too light, held together by weak bonds, and also held together by disulfide bonds, which are here, these heavy black lines, not only between two light heavy chains, but also between each heavy chain and the light chain. So the immunoglobulins have locked in these four subunits together by strong covalent bonds as well. If you would break these bonds, it would still actually hold together. And it would renature. You could renature hemoglobin under in the absence of oxygen, and these it would fold into its normal state, even without these cysteines. But the cysteines, you know, help make it more stable. Now that we know a little bit more about protein structure, let's go back to sickle cell disease and see if we can explain Ingram's result. Here's a red blood cell, and it's got these blue balls with X's through them. So that's to signify the four subunits. Each pi piece here is either an alpha or a beta. So the whole hemoglobin molecule is this circle. In normal case, this is just chock full of these molecules. In the sickle cell, you have this distortion, and you see there's actually this more organized association at a higher level, that the tetramers are all associated with each other. And so we can sort of understand what's going on when we consider the normal globin has glutamate someplace, and it actually is near the surface, as you might expect. So when one of these hemoglobin molecules approaches another, And those two particular parts happen to touch, you have no particular attraction between these two because they're both negatively charged. In fact, you might expect, because they're negatively charged, that they repel each other. And so they're kept separate. And that's good because each one is already doing its job. It doesn't need to be stuck to somebody else. Now we've substituted in people with sickle disease a valine for that glutamate. Now, the valine has a hydrophobic chain. So now, when you have that same kind of collision of the same two surfaces here, you have the possibility of a hydrophobic interaction. Now, one hydrophobic interaction is too weak to hold these together. It's only the combination of many of these weak bonds, as in cellulose or starch, that gives the structure any kind of long lifetime. But it could be that around this glutamate molecule, there are a lot of other hydrophobic groups or possibilities for hydrogen bonding. And And the globin has evolved to make sure that those other guys are not going to glue these two molecules together. And so we'll put in, and so we have a glutamate negative to make sure it doesn't happen. Now that's been removed and even made worse by adding one interaction that would tend to associate these two molecules. And so you get, not all the time, but you get cases where you get now the... I've lost my pointer. Where you get associations into long chains, and that's what's causing this distortion of the red blood cell. And they bind oxygen just fine, but they cause this blockages in the small capillaries. There's a few more topics, or maybe just one more topic on protein structure that we should consider. And that is, although a protein is a polypeptide chain or several polypeptide chains associated with each other, when we isolate the protein, we find sometimes additional molecules. And these are small molecules that are not polypeptides, they're not amino acids. They're other things. They're like vitamin B6, pyridoxal, which has a rather simple structure like this. It's got this aldehyde group at the top. And we find certain enzymes have associated with them this small molecule. And when I say associated, I mean if you purify the protein and away from everything else, and then you look at its composition, you find there's always a pyridoxal, one for every polypeptide chain here. So it's strongly associated. And that association can be of two types. Exceptionally, like in the case of pyridoxal, it's actually covalently bonded to the protein. So after the protein is made, it bumps into pyridoxal. Pyridoxal has a phosphate in this case. This is the pyridoxal part, and there's the phosphate. And it it binds it and actually reacts with one of the side chains of the protein. So when it's bound, you have a CH2-4NH here, the blue part. That's just a lysine side chain. And it's right there where the pyridoxal's aldehyde is sitting. And if you have an amine and an aldehyde, they can undergo a reaction, something with each other, so you get this new covalent bond form. Now we have a double bond between the N of the lysine and the C of what was the aldehyde. And the rest of the molecule remains the same. There's also a hydrogen bond that could form here, or a ion dipole bond that could form here to sort of lock in the position of this pyridoxal. And the pyridoxal is very important. It's a vitamin, and this is why. It's very important for the action of this enzyme. More commonly, these small molecule groups, which if they're associated with protein are called prosthetic groups, are only bonded by weak interactions, but enough weak interactions so that they are very tightly held by the protein. So examples again are often vitamins like tetrahydrofolic acid, which is a form of folic acid. It's the active form of folic acid. Vitamin B9, riboflavin, see here in the lower left, and useful in energy metabolism. Let me rejuvenate my. This pointer just eats these batteries. And heme, we talked about hemoglobin. Well, that's the heme in hemoglobin is this very large small molecule with an iron that's bound in the middle by ionic interactions with these amino groups. And it's got this ring structure, and it's got other groups hanging off the ring. And that's every one of the subunits of hemoglobin has one of these hemes. So hemoglobin has four hemes bound to it. Tucked inside, accessible, however, to oxygen, and the oxygen is actually binding to this iron. So the whole protein is designed to hold this heme and uses the heme as a prosthesis. It uses the heme to bind the oxygen because it itself was unable to do a good job just using the 20 different side chains of the amino acids. So this increases the diversity of proteins. Yes?
I'm sorry, did you say enzymes can be
Enzymes are not prosthetic groups. What the question was, are enzymes prosthetic groups? The prosthetic groups are always small molecules, non-amino acids. They could have usually not related to amino acids, but they're small molecules, and these are the cofactors and the vitamins that were about a dozen or so in the E. coli cell. And what you find them is attached to enzymes, which are proteins, which are... So we've been considering always the proteins in aqueous solution, but in fact about a third of the proteins in a skin cell, I'm not sure about E. coli, which doesn't have a lot of membrane, but mammalian cells have a lot of membrane, especially things like, and a lot of protein goes into these membranes. So there's maybe a third of the protein. It's not like this tiny amount, right? So what's happening here? Here, everything's sort of reversed, as you might expect. Here's a protein that's stuck into the membrane called an integral membrane protein because it's always associated with the membrane and is found there. So it's got this little end over here in the bottom, graphic 30, that's sticking, let's say, inside the cell, right? And the rest of it is residing inside the membrane, cuddled up with these fatty acid side chains. So you might expect the outside of this protein not to be hydrophilic, but in fact to be hydrophobic. And indeed, that's what it is. And that's what pushed it here. It's got all these hydrophobic side chains on the outside. And as it's made, and it's something you'll learn about in cell biology, even as it's made, it gets inserted into a membrane. Right? So you have different kinds of such groups. Here's one that a membrane-spanning protein. It's like a cylinder. This is the parts that are interacting with the membrane fatty acids are hydrophobic on the outside, and here at the top and the bottom we have hydrophilic groups which keep it localized right here. It can't go further down and can't go further up because hydrophobic forces would just push this out to maximize the hydrophobic interactions between the membrane protein surface and the membrane itself. As you can imagine, as we've gone from membrane spanning, these such proteins, this could be a signaling protein, for instance. So you could have something from the outside impinging on the part that's sticking out on the outside of the membrane, and then the protein changes its shape a little bit and is able to do something it couldn't do before here on the inside of the cell, and you have a way of conducting a message from the outside to the inside. And again, you'll learn more about that in cell biology next semester. Or you can imagine this is a channel, that this membrane-spanning protein is hollow. So it's built maybe with a bunch of alpha helices making a cylinder with a lot of space now on the inside among all the alpha helices, or beta sheet. And this is what you find, you know, beta sheets that are curved and have a space in between big enough for other molecules to go through. Big enough for some molecules to go through, but not other molecules. So you could build these in such a way so that they're okay for like sodium ions, but not for potassium ions. It would be too big, right? One is bigger than the other. Or big enough for glycine to come through, but too small for tryptophan to come through. So you can already... use this channel diameter as a basis of discrimination of one channel versus another channel. You can get more fancy, right? You could have inside here, there's water also. So you could have water. And because now that part of it is insulated by this, you know, in three dimensions, this is a cylinder with a hydrophobic shell, but inside it could be aqueous. And suppose you had a lot of lysine positively charged side groups in here, that are positives. So these positives are part of the side chains. Now, if you have, you could discriminate molecules coming through. Suppose you had a sodium over here. So sodium would, a lot of it on the outside would want to go in just by mass action. But every time it starts to try, it just gets repelled by this lysine positive charge. So it never even gets in the door. On the other hand, a chloride ion, which is negative, gets over here, binds right away. That's fine. And then it lets go and goes back out. And another one binds, and instead of letting go and going back out, it lets go and goes further in. And if there's more chloride up here than down here, then gradually, or not so gradually, you'll have the chloride ions making their way, binding to these positive groups, and finally being by chance coming off on the bottom. And that chance will be greater if there's a lot more on the outside than the inside. So here's a channel that's selective for size and selective for the charge on the molecule going through. So you can see how the proteins could be designed to interact with some specificity for small molecules. This is small potatoes compared to all the other proteins who use that principle. That's just a reminder of what an anion and cation are. Think of just an enzyme, right? That's got to do something, we're going to talk about soon. To do something with some small molecule, it has to bind it first. So here's a yellow protein A that's binding glycine. And you have glycine has just a hydrogen side chain. Let's say that's the part that's hanging down, right? And let's say it's using, again, I've made this up just for illustration. It's using a negatively charged side group on the protein surface here to form an ionic bond with the amino group of glycine and likewise on the other side. And just the right distance apart for an amino acid, which is the same for all amino acids, the carboxyl group of the amino acid interacting with a positively charged, say, arginine here on the surface of this protein. And a little pocket here, a little tiny pocket just to accommodate this hydrogen atom, and that's kept there by van der Waals forces. So you got just fits right. You have these ionic bonds and the van der Waals, and everybody acting together. You have pretty tight binding of glycine to the surface of protein A. Now you try to bind alanine in there. Alanine compared to the hydrogen is now we've got CH3, a lot bigger than a hydrogen atom. So it has a lot of trouble, and in fact it can. I said poor binding, I should have said no binding. It cannot approach close enough for these ionic bonds to have import. So this protein A can discriminate between glycine and alanine. It will not bind alanine, it binds glycine just fine. An interesting sidelight would be, suppose this is, of course, the amino acids in the cell are mostly these L amino acids. Suppose this were a D amino acid. If this were a D amino acid, you could consider this methyl group and this hydrogen reversed. And now the methyl group would be out here if it's holding on to the carboxyl with the left hand and the amino group with this right hand. Now that hydrogen would be facing down, and maybe it would bind D alanine. But there is no D-alanine, so its point is mute unless you're trying to make a drug. But I just bring that up to show you how the three dimensions, the three-dimensional aspects are, again, all important here. If you wanted to bind alanine, you'd have to have a different protein that's designed for alanine. So here, this pocket is much bigger. It's going to make, could be some hydrophobics in here. You're going to have nice multiple van der Waal forces. And now you can dip down far enough so that your ionic bonds on the two ends of your amino acid central part of the amino acid can now form those ionic interactions and accommodate this big methyl group, or let's say a lysine group, this four CH2s, and you can imagine there's some negative charge at the bottom holding on to that positive charge on the end of the lysine side chain. So proteins are built to do this, to have crevices in their surface, pockets that will be specifically bind one molecule and not a thousand other molecules. More realistic picture, the space-filling model. I don't know exactly where this is from. But here's a space-filling model of a protein, and that just gives you an idea of how intimate the contact is between the small molecule and the pocket of the protein. A small molecule that binds and then is let go is not a prosthetic group. It's not always found with the protein, but binds tightly and can be bound, or not so tightly, but can be bound specifically, is called a ligand. So any small molecule that binds a large molecule, or a protein in this case, is called a ligand. The yellow is the protein, the red is the ligand. Here's some more specificity. This is an actual case. So this is a picture of the estrogen receptor that carries a signal to mobilize a cell to do something if it meets up with estrogen. from the bloodstream. So here's our estrogen in green here, nestled into a pocket pretty deep into the top domain of this two-domain protein. See the domains in light blue and dark blue. So here's estrogen, very similar to testosterone, so completely opposite kind of effects, right? These are sex hormones and, let's say, secondary sexual traits. Although we both, males and females, both have both kinds of hormones in them, but females have more estrogen and males have more testosterone. So look at the difference in these two molecules. Estrogen has this OH on the lower left ring. Testosterone has a C double bond O, which is sort of a little smaller, I guess. Doesn't have that hydrogen, but not by much. Plus, it's got this methyl group that doesn't exist in estrogen. Estrogen receptor will bind, here it is, in a non-space-filling model, a backbone stick model. There's the estrogen with its rings nestled in here. And if you put testosterone on this receptor, it's completely ignored. I guess it just can't fit with that methyl group sticking out. Okay. Now we're going to take an interlude on methods again. Just as we talked about small molecules and their separation to learn a little bit more about them, so we're going to use separation methods for proteins for that purpose, and also because it's very important, because I couldn't talk about what the estrogen receptor does, for example, unless I had a purified estrogen receptor protein. So there's 20,000 different proteins in our skin cell. I want to talk about the human estrogen receptor. Then I would have to remove 19,999 just to have that single one. So purification of proteins means separation of proteins, one from the other. Isolation. So I'll talk about several different methods. The first is ultracentrifugation, so that you can separate on the basis of size and shape. So size, I think, is easy to understand. If you had a centrifuge and you put a mixture of proteins at the top and you put it from a top view of a centrifuge and swing it around, then these molecules will be subjected to centrifugal force and tend to move towards the bottom of the tube. But because they're so small, proteins, just molecules, not like we're sedimenting cells, which are huge, we have to use quite a bit of centrifugal force, something like 100,000 G, which we can get by spinning at 60,000 RPM. Now, 60,000 RPM is quite fast. That's why this is not a centrifuge. It's an ultracentrifuge. And to spin that fast, we have to take special measures. For instance, the rotor here, in the presence of air, would heat up so much at 60,000 RPM. You know, a car, a Porsche, accelerating to go 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, is spinning at about 5,000 RPM, that engine. Right? So this is, and it goes by the square. So this is, that is, the force goes by the square, as we'll see. So so you have to do this in a vacuum, so there's no air around. And generally, if it's proteins, you want to keep them cold so that they don't denature. So you need a refrigerated vacuum centrifuge. It's like $100,000. So under this condition, larger will go down faster, and smaller will go down slower. Oh, here's a picture of that, right? So here's our $100,000 machine. Here's the rotor. That's a side group. So you have two kinds of rotors. Sometimes you have like a fixed angle, or sometimes this is called a swinging bucket. And these little buckets, and the tube is inside, just swing out horizontally. Here's a fixed angle rotor. What's causing the centrifugation? Centrifugal force works by on the mass, and that's why there's more force on a larger mass. Omega, which I couldn't get the symbol for, omega squared is the rotational velocity in RPMs or radians per second, whatever your taste. And R is the distance from the center of rotation. So, you know, if you're swinging a bucket of water, keeping that water in, you'll have more force with a further away from your arm that bucket is. And so these are related to each other in this formula up here. The centrifugal force is linearly related to the mass, the square of the rotational velocity, and linearly related to the
to the distance from the center. So the distance from the center is fixed for a given rotor, and the rotational velocity you're in charge of by dialing it up. So under those experimental conditions, the force is just dependent on the mass. However, there is something that's preventing is acting against the centrifugal force, and that is a frictional force of the solvent, water usually, or salts. Mostly water molecules have some viscosity. And as the particles, or in this case proteins, start to go down, they're subjected to this frictional force. So how is the frictional force defined? It's defined as a number that's related to how slippery that molecule is, right? For getting down. And I'll talk about it more in a second. So that's constant for any particular protein, and it's dependent on the shape. And the other is the velocity. So you have friction, you know, you rub two sticks together, you don't get very hot, but if you rub them very fast, you get higher friction and more heat. So the frictional force dependent on the velocity. So that's key, because as you go down, you're going to be accelerated by the centrifugal force, right? And so you're going to be going faster and faster because there's a force, and that velocity will keep increasing, but as it increases, the frictional force increases. So at some point, these two are going to cancel each other. And then what happens? Does the molecule stop moving? No. Molecule's still moving, but it's not accelerating anymore. So a body in motion, if it's acted on by no net force, tends to stay in motion. Body at rest stays at rest unless you put a force on it. So it gets going, but as it gets going, the frictional force gets greater and greater until it's equal to the centrifugal force, but you're in a steady condition now and you just keep going down. If it helps, it's like a skydiver, right? It reaches a constant velocity. Or you could use this to understand the skydiver. Coefficient was the word I wanted, yes. So the F is a coefficient that depends on the shape of the molecule. They balance out, and so you can make these two terms equivalent, and you end up, in the end, with the velocity is equal to what rotor you're using, R, how fast you set the machine to go, omega squared. Those are a little bit boring, but from the biochemical point of view, it's directly related to the mass and inversely related to the frictional coefficient. And the frictional coefficient will depend on the shape. The least frictional force, it turns out to be a sphere. Anything that deviates from sphericality will slow the molecule down. So you can readily imagine that with a pancake, or let's say you take a BB and a feather, both the same weight, and you drop them in the fluid of air, and they reach a constant velocity, and the feather is taking its time going down. BB goes straight down. Right? They weigh the same mass. Right? Now you might think, how about a cigar? Right? A cigar is a not spherical shape, but that should just slice through these water molecules. But that's because in your mind, you're saying that would be the preferable shape for it to go point down, straight through. But you're in no control of the cigar shape. Nobody is. That cigar shape takes on random dances, and so it's turning around like a windmill. Most of the time, it's in the unfavorable case where it's horizontal relative to where it's going, and that presents a bigger surface area and more friction than a sphere. So the sphere is the fastest. Okay, you don't really learn this stuff until you start applying it in your problems, and we have plenty of problems. Centrifugation, etc. That's where you'll learn it. I give you a framework from which to learn it here. How about electrophoresis, as we use for the amino acids? So here's instead of paper, we're going to use here instead a gel. And we're going to form this gel using chemicals that will polymerize, or we can melt and put back together, like Jell-O. In this case, we're using a plastic monomer called acrylamide, and that if we add some catalyst, we can get it to form polyacrylamide, sort of like that polyethylene we talked about earlier. It's kind of a plastic.
But if you have a lot of water around, it'll form a gel with the consistency of Jell-O. The usual way is you form it between two, there's a side view between two glass plates, and you seal the ends and you let it polymerize. It takes about 20 minutes. And now you have this gel between the two glass plates. And now we turn it so it faces us, and we have this sandwich, and we're looking straight onto it. We put our proteins at the top. We put, say, the anode at the top and the cathode at the bottom, and stick it into a device that will hold it in that way. Apply the voltage, and the molecules will start to migrate. Those that are positively charged will migrate towards the cathode. Those that are negatively charged will go towards the anode, right out of the gel, lost forever. So in this case, which is called native polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis, you can only look at about half of the molecules that have a net positive charge. How do you know what the charge is on a polypeptide or a protein? This is very mild, pH 7, do it in the cold if you want. So you could have hemoglobin, all four, stay together. You just count up the glutamates and the lysines and the arginines and the aspartates, just as you did for that composite polypeptide that we talked about in paper chromatography, in fingerprinting, rather. So you get very easily the net charge, and if it's positive in this setup, it will go towards the cathode. But it will have a second characteristic which could be drawn upon. If these fibers that make up the polyacrylamide are sufficiently tight, which they usually are, then they present a hindrance to this mobility. And so small guys that are positively charged, like here, these triangles, they have everything going for them. They have a lot of positive charge, so the force on them is going to be greater, the electromotive force bringing them here. And they can easily negotiate between this network of fibers, and so they win. The losers have the least positive charge. The real losers go in the opposite direction. But on this separation, the losers among the positively charged molecules are those that have the weakest positive charge, maybe just plus one. And they're also large, and so they have trouble. They have to find a hole, dance around, find another hole, and finally make their way down. And you can imagine everything in between. So you could have small charge, intermediates large, but they have a lot of charge, but they're large, so they have some trouble. Or they don't have much charge, but they're very small. So you can't predict exactly. If you didn't know what your protein is, and generally you don't when you're starting, it could be anywhere in this gel. Or you might run it again. If you don't see it, you might run it again and reverse the electrodes. So here's just a picture of this apparatus. And here it's just held together with clamps. And it's got little spacers here. And here's a reservoir in the bottom and a reservoir on the top. That's connected to your electrophoresis machine. And you have usually tracking dyes, so you know how long to do this for. You take it out. Doesn't always look so pretty. Okay. And you can take out the gel and dry it down. So next time, we'll continue with electrophoresis under a quite different condition.